When we talk about suffering, we're really talking about one of those subjects that you can know straight away touches everybody you talk to. There'll be some people here this morning who've really suffered very seriously. I'm sure there are some people who will soon suffer very seriously, this year, next year. And there'll be others of us who will suffer very seriously, perhaps later. Not too many people get to the end of their lives without suffering seriously. Could be the suffering of chronic pain, disease. Could be the suffering of a bereavement, so that every day just thoughts crowd your mind of what might have been and isn't. Could be the excruciating suffering of sexual abuse that just wouldn't stop. And that's left its mark, so that you suffer today because of what happened then. Could be marital betrayal. Could be the death of a child at the hands of a drunken driver. Could be unloving parents. It could be friends who've robbed you of your reputation. And that doesn't even begin to touch the millions of people who this year will suffer because of war, and tsunamis, and the AIDS epidemic. I mean, the field is enormous, and the depth of the result is huge. What do you do with all that? Now, if you're an atheistic evolutionist, like Richard Dawkins — now, Richard Dawkins is in the news now. He's put out his book that says God is nonsense, more or less. He's been on television, he's got the press, the ear of the press. He really says all you can do in the face of all this stuff is really just shrug your shoulders. He says, quote, "In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, or any justice. The universe that we observe has no evil and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." Now, I tell you, if your kids are run over by a car, don't go to him for help. It's just a bit of bad luck, and you can't explain it. There's no rhyme or reason. There's not even any such thing as evil, he says. If you're a Muslim, you've just got to resign yourself to the impersonal plan of Allah. It's just fate. I mean, there isn't a why to it, not a rhyme or reason. It's just the way it is. And there's really no help if you're a Muslim in the middle of all that. And if you're a good postmodern Australian, you've only got the God that you can invent for yourself. If you happen to ask the question why — though goodness knows why you'd ask the question why, if there isn't any right or wrong or good or bad or God or not God — it's up to you to work out an answer if you ask why. It's really, seems to me that one of the ways that you can show the hopelessness of human ideas and human philosophies, whether they're Richard Dawkins or Islam's or anything else, is to ask, has it got anything to say about evil and suffering? And all those come unstuck on that very point, other points as well, but on that one at least. They've got nothing to say. There's no hope, there's no rhyme, there's no reason. I suppose the more important question for us this morning is, does the Bible got anything to say? Does God of the Bible have any sort of place in what he's doing for awful, deep suffering that's hard to comprehend? And indeed, really the question I want to ask this morning is, does the grace of God have anything to do with that? If God somehow got it somewhere in here, how does his grace touch that? And that's what we want to think about this weekend. And it's important to think about, you see, because I think most Christians today really haven't got any idea how God fits with evil and suffering. I'm sure that's true. That's a bit of a generalisation. I'm sure it's generally true. People, often Christians, I mean good, Bible-believing, evangelical Christians. God gives us the nice stuff, pleasant, easy, comfortable, but the bad stuff, painful, arduous, heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching, well, that comes from the devil. That comes from bad luck. That comes from evil people. And so you've got this idea that God's over here with all the good stuff, and all the bad stuff, the unpleasant stuff, the hurting stuff somehow is over here, and God's got no connection with it. I didn't hear the interview, but one of the fellows here heard the interview on ABC Radio after the tsunami of a couple of years ago, and Tim Costello came back from visiting parts of Indonesia where he'd seen the destruction of the tsunami. Tim Costello, president of World Vision Australia, for a time president of the Baptist Union of Australia, Melbourne pastor, brother of Peter Costello, etc., etc., you know the guy. He came back, he was interviewed on ABC Radio, and the interviewer said to him, "What do you make of it all? How does God fit with this?" Or a question to that effect. His words were, I think almost word for word, "God would have liked to have stopped it, but couldn't." Why, he said, he couldn't even stop his own son being killed. I quote that, I think, the last part I know I have word for word, the first part I think also. You see, God's over here, nice God, the rotten things are over here, and there's just no connection between the two. God would like to stop this here, but he's over here. Now, I want to tell you that I think that's probably a pretty common sort of view in different shades of an or another. But that's nothing like the view of God that the Bible presents us. It's nothing like it. In the Bible, God is so big that he has everything to do with evil and suffering. And his grace has everything to do with it. I want to try and show how this morning. The Bible says a lot about suffering. I think when I was making my notes and preparing for this, I had 17 themes about suffering and how the grace of God touches evil and suffering. And I've settled on three of the 17. So a lot will get unsaid, but that'll have to be, because what we're saying, I think, is the most important part, if I may suggest. And the first thing I want to say, the first major thing I want to say this morning, is that God's plan includes evil and suffering. Murray talked this morning from Ephesians chapter 1 about the fact that God has a plan. And it's a plan full of wonderfully good things. Now the trouble is, things in our world keep going wrong. And so certainly what a lot of Christians say is, well, because things keep going wrong, people sin, pastors commit adultery, houses fall in and kill people, and so on and so on. Because these things go wrong, God says, "Oh, my plan was really good, but now it's being wrecked by all these things." And so God has to invent a second kind of plan that takes into account these things that are happening. So he goes from plan A to plan B. And so plan B is humming along. Oh, then something else happens that God sort of wasn't part of what he really wanted. So it's plan C, and plan D, and plan E, and so on, and so on, and so on. Now that's the view I think that many Christians hold today. God has to keep resorting to something else because evil and suffering keeps wrecking what he wanted to do. Well, that may be the way a lot of people see it, but I tell you, it's not even within a bull's roar of what the Bible says. Not even close. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 11, we saw this morning, says, verse 11, "In him we were also chosen, having been predestined according to his plan, the plan of him who works out everything in conformity with his purpose." Now, folks, I don't know what the word "everything" means to you. To me, it's pretty encompassing. It doesn't say he works out the nice things, the good things, the happy things, the positive things. It doesn't say the big things or the little things, it just says everything. God works out everything in this world according to his purpose, according to his plan. He doesn't go to plan B. What he does is always according to plan A. all that God does in this world. It's a plan that's eternal. We saw that before the world was made. Chapter 1, verse 4. God planned this and this and this. It's a plan before time, and it's a plan that time won't diminish and won't wreck. The cancer or the tsunami or the car accident doesn't take him by surprise, folks. They're always part of plan A. They're always part of the plan of God, who works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will. Now, I don't know what could be plainer than that, to be quite honest. We need to say more than that, but boy, we sure can't say less. And if I said, well, where's his will going? Where's his plan going? Well, again, Murray told us this morning, God is working out everything so that it will be to the praise of his glory, to the praise of his glory, to the praise of his glory. It doesn't say he's working out everything so that we'll be happy. It doesn't say he's working out everything so that we'll understand it all. He's doing it all so that in the end, in ways that I can't really understand, I've got to say, but I know for a fact that in the end it will be to his glory. That in the end everything will be summed up under Christ, and Christ will get the glory. That's his purpose, to bring everything in heaven and earth together under one head, even Christ. That's where it's going. There will be glory for Christ out of the tsunami, out of the car accident, out of the cancer. There will be. There will be. You say, how can you see that? I'm not saying I can see it. I know it. God says that's the way it is. Let me give you two case histories. In the notes it says there are four, but I'll only have time for two, I'm sure. Let me give you the case history, first of all, of Joseph. You know Joseph, the man who occupies more of Genesis than Abraham and anybody else in terms of space. Joseph, teenage Joseph, hated by his brothers. Jealous of him. I mean, he provoked them, and you can perhaps understand their jealousy a bit, but they very seriously, wrongly consign him to death. And they sell him off to slave traders who are going to Egypt, and that was a death sentence. I mean, in a labour camp, or even working for some employer somewhere in Egypt, you might last 2 years, 4 years, 8 years, but it's a death sentence. They know he won't last. And so it's off to Egypt with Joseph. And you know that when he's there, by God's providence, he's exalted, he's raised up, and he becomes virtually the prime minister of Egypt. And God gave him so much wisdom and insight during those years that when there's just heaps of crop, just beautiful, he stores it all, wheat, corn, whatever it was, stores it into these silos. I mean, the place is just awash with grain. Because God had said 7 years is coming after these seven good years when there'll be nothing. And so when the seven bad years come, Egypt's got more grain than it knows what to do with. It's going to last far more than 7 years if Egypt is the only consumer. But what happens, of course, is that people from other nations come. And they say, we hear you've got it stacked in here. You're loaded. Share some with us. And some of the people who come for help are the brothers of Joseph, who at least 15 years before have sold him into slavery, knowing that 2 years, 4 years, he'll be dead. They come. And the person with whom they have to deal to get the grain to take back home is Joseph. They're convinced he's dead. Years have changed him. Don't know what else happened, but they don't recognise him. They come and they ask him for grain. And in the course of the conversations that followed, with many tears, Joseph reveals to them who he is. And in Genesis chapter 45, in verse 4, Joseph said to his brothers, come close to me. When they'd done so, he said, I'm your brother, Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. Now, do not be distressed. I mean, I'd be distressed if I were them. I mean, this is the prime minister. He's got soldiers behind him with swords and spears. And here are the guys who are trying to kill him. Yeah, of course they ought to be distressed. Don't be distressed, he says. Don't be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me here ahead of you. It was to save lives that God sent me here. What did he say? It was because of your sin I ended up here. Because it is, as it were, that he goes, he looks behind what you can see, and he sees what you can't see, but which is more real. God sent me here. It was His plan. It wasn't an accident. God sent me here to save lives. And then He helps them. And if you want to, if the point's not even as not clear there, if you go to the last chapter of Genesis, into chapter 50, when his father, old Jacob, has died, and the brothers now think, oh, Dad's dead, now he'll do us in. He's only keeping us alive because Dad was alive, but Jacob's dead, and now they're a bit worried, I think. But they need not have worried. Verse 15, chapter 50, Genesis verse 15, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him? So they sent word to Joseph. This is a great scheme they cook up. Your father left these instructions. This is what you're to say to him. So they said, they make this scheme that somehow means that Joseph will be kind to them. Joseph said to them, verse 19, don't be afraid. Vengeance belongs to the Lord. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. What was their intention? If we took the English Standard Version, which is a better translation, you meant evil against me, but God meant it, the evil, not your action, the evil that you did, God intended it for good. Now, I don't know what could be plainer. I mean, let's ask the question. Let's review it. Was the action of the brothers evil? Absolutely. Did people suffer because of their action? You bet they did. Joseph suffered. His father suffered. Other people suffered. There's evil and there's suffering. There's no question about that. Was their action all part of the wise, perfect, eternal plan of God? You bet it was. God sent me here. The evil that you did, God intended it, the evil, for good. To preserve the people of Egypt, to preserve people in other nations, to preserve the people of Israel so that the Messiah would come, as promised. Your action fulfilled the salvation of the people so that the Messiah might come, if we can put it like that. Yes, there's evil. Yes, there's suffering. But over it all, we'd ask, did their plan, did their action catch God off guard? Did he have to change his plan? Did it wreck his plan? Folks, it was always part of his plan. Now, that's number one. Just keep that one side of your brain. Look at the other one. We won't do Job and Judas. That'd be great case studies. Jesus, Acts chapter 2. Peter is preaching on the day of Pentecost, speaking about Jesus. Acts 2, verse 22. How wonderful was the life and the work and the ministry of Jesus. Verse 23. This man, Jesus, was handed over to you by God's set purpose and foreknowledge. And you Jews, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. Now ask the same questions. Was their action evil? Yes. It was sinful. Yes, there's been no greater sin, if I can speak like that, than their action in murdering the Lord of life. Was there suffering because of their action? Yes, there was. No one has suffered as much as Jesus suffered on the cross. There was great suffering, evil and suffering. Absolutely, yes. How did that happen? It happened according to God's set purpose and foreknowledge, all according to plan A. With all its evil, with all its suffering, a plan that meant great things, but along the way involved much evil and much suffering.
Go over to chapter 4 of Acts, please, if you would, to verse 27. Not Peter this time. This is some of the believers praying. It wasn't just sort of heady idea that an apostle had somewhere. This is the common belief of the Christians. And they can speak about the way in which Jesus was conspired against, verse 27. And then verse 28, they say, they, Pontius Pilate, Herod, Gentiles, Jews, they did what your power and your will had decided beforehand should happen. Now put that in your pipe and smoke it. They did what your power and your will had decided beforehand should happen. Now, folks, what could be plainer? Evil? Yes, gross evil. Suffering? Enormous suffering. Part of the plan of God that goes back before eternity. Now, let me be very clear, or as clear as I can be. Am I saying that God is evil? Or am I even saying that God does evil from an evil heart? No, I'm not. We know full well the Bible says that the God of the judge of all the earth always does what's right. There's no evil in God. It's impossible for God to do evil. He does not do evil, but he plans it and he brings it. We've seen from the cases how he brought it. But we know that God himself is not evil. I mean, there are hundreds of places in the Bible we could look at the way in which God sent an evil spirit to King Saul. We could see the way in which he sent suffering and disease. We could say 100 things. God's all the time sending evil that results in suffering. I'm not saying God is evil. The Bible denies that very emphatically. Nor am I saying God intends evil. But boy, it's part of his plan, which is always good. Was the tsunami or 9/11 beyond his control? Was it something in the sense that he said, well, I'm really doing these things here, but boy, I'd like to stop these Muslim terrorists, I'd like to stop these forces in the ocean, but really it's not like that, folks. It's not like that. That's part of the plan. God's plan includes everything. He works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will, Ephesians 1:11. Everything. 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 He doesn't do evil, but boy, does he bring it. And he brings it for the triumph of his plan. Now, folks, I'm not saying to you for a minute, and I hope you hear me here, I'm not saying for a minute, I understand how what happened to you or to your child or to your neighbour works for God's glory. I don't. Mind you, I need to know how it's going to work if I'm running the world. But if I'm not running the world, I don't need to know how it works. I just got to trust that God knows how it works and he's running the world. Now, don't ask me to answer questions, as it were, that I can't answer. I'm trying to answer the ones I can. And God is so clear about the way in which evil and suffering are a part of his plan. Look, we need to know that because Satan's not running the show. And some Christians just go through life cringing as though somehow the devil or his demons or something else and green things on the roof are somehow going to get hold of them. And it's all going to sort of fall apart. Satan's never been running the show. Not yesterday, not last year, not at the beginning, not ever. God's always been running the show. It's not as though evil's out of control. All these dreadful things happening and, oh, what are we going to do? No, no, evil's never been out of control. Christians need never panic. Whether it's personal things or national things, physical things or emotional things. You don't need, Satan doesn't hold, it's not in his hand. He's not controlling things, he's not running things. There are no no-go areas with God. God's in every area. You got it? Thank you for that nod at the back. He's in every area. There are no no-go areas with God. So whether today for me is wonderful and tomorrow is full of sadness, that's from the hand of my Heavenly Father.
And that's why I say, if God is for me, what can possibly be against me? You say, but look at these things happening to you. I said, they're not going to wreck me. They're not going to take me away from God. Because God has all these things in his hand. They are part of his will, and his will is always good. And friends, I suppose I ought to say this before I just go to the second point. As we talk about the way in which God's plan includes evil and suffering, what have I done? Ultimately, it means that suffering and evil are not about me. You know, we have such a pathetic view, many of us. Now, I'm not saying, I haven't suffered very much, I've got to say that. Not yet. A bit. Some's emotional, some's physical, child that dies, illness, also, I mean, that's the normal sort of thing that happens to lots of people. But I haven't suffered lots. I've got to say that and be honest with you. Some people have suffered a lot more than I have. I know that. But I tell you, what happens when we suffer is that sometimes we think, our world becomes so small, and it's almost as though everything is about us. It's all about me, how I get through, what's happening to me. Well, I will ask what's happening to me, and I will ask what lessons I can learn from what God's doing. I ought to do that. But ultimately, it's not about me. God's working out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will to the praise of his glory. I can relax. Whether I see the purpose or not, irrelevant. Whether I feel good about it or not, in a sense, it's not the question. God does it all for the praise of his glory. Not about me. But what happens is always the best. Because God does always what's right. The judge of all the earth does what's right. It's always been like that. I can trust him. Well, God's plan includes evil and suffering. And secondly, I have to be brief here, God's grace works through suffering. Two ways. You know, our suffering so often can take us to Jesus and always is meant to take us to Jesus. You know, there's some pain that medication doesn't touch. You know that. I mean, some of you can say, you know, if I told you my history as a child, there's no way a doctor can go where I was, in sense, in my head or in my heart. And I still carry that with me. You've been disappointed. Somebody you loved failed you. Some gross person just about destroyed you. That's serious stuff. And your friends, even your best friends, don't really understand what it's like. They can't. And the pain just won't go away. Well, friends, let me tell you, some of it's not meant to go away. Some of it's not meant to be fixed by medicine or doctors. God means to hurt you. In other words, God means you to feel the pain so that you'll get something better than relief from the pain. So you'll say, I can't do it. And so like Paul says, look, we endure this and this that we might learn not to rely on ourselves. My friends can't help me. Now why does he do that? So that I'll go to the one who alone can help me. I'll hear the words of Jesus. Come to me, all who are weighed down and burdened, and I'll give you rest. Don't drink at the wells where there's no water. Come to me and drink. And God means our pain to take us that way. God means the evil and the suffering that results in the pain to take us that way. Doesn't mean that your past changes when you come to Jesus. Can't change your past. But I tell you, you learn not to have to live in it. And you won't be able to change your future. But you know Jesus is the one who orders the future. You know that the hand that holds you is the hand that holds the world. It's a great place to be. God means us to feel the pain of a fallen world. He means us to see that there's something wrong with everything. So as Peter says, we'll commit ourselves
to a faithful Creator. Not just saying, chin up, press on. No, not talking about that. Not saying, just grit your teeth and get on with the job. Commit yourself to your faithful Creator. You call out to Him for what you need. And you trust Him for what you need. And you actively commit to going His way, whether you understand it or not. You know, when you're hurt, there are some choices to be made. We all do it, whether we list the choices or not. Some people pretend it doesn't hurt. They're fools. It's meant to hurt. Don't pretend it doesn't. Some people try and just tough it out. Some people spend their life looking for fixes. Some people just cave in and grow self-absorbed. Well, the other choice is, in your pain and in your suffering, you can run to Jesus. You know, suffering's like the effect of the sun, the effect of the heat of the sun. Same sun, same heat, hardens the clay, melts the ice. Suffering is meant to melt me. Whether it's suffering I see in you, or in Indonesia, or somewhere else, meant to melt me so I can say, who can explain these things? Who can actually touch our hearts and our minds in the middle of them? Only Jesus. Only my best friends won't even get close. My spouse won't get close. Only Jesus. So why on earth would you tough it out when you can melt into the arms of Jesus? The arms that hold the world. Our suffering takes Jesus, and lastly, Jesus takes our suffering to Himself. Some of us have suffered a little, others of us have suffered greatly. But I tell you, if we put all our suffering together in this room, it would be peanuts compared with the suffering that Jesus endured. It'd be nothing by comparison. Mocked as a bastard, misunderstood by his family, hated for telling the truth, judged on the basis of trumped up charges by a prejudiced jury, betrayed by his closest friends, tortured, dying in agony, and cut off from his Father, with whom he'd always been one since all eternity. No one has suffered like Jesus has suffered. Why was it his Father's will that he suffer so? Well, I tell you, folks, he suffered the greatest suffering so that I might escape the second greatest suffering. He suffered most that I might not have to suffer the most suffering that a human can suffer, which are the pains of hell. When they hurled their insults at Jesus, he didn't retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree. By his wounds, you've been healed. By his greatest suffering, I won't suffer the greatest suffering it's possible for any human being to endure. I should be cut off from God, but he was. I should suffer my sins for my sins, but they were placed on him. I should go to hell where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth day after day after day after day. It never stops. But he suffered. He suffered, so I won't. Folks, you know, when we suffer, we lose perspective so easily. But if ever there was a time we need good perspective, it's when we suffer. And this is part of the things we need to, this is part of what we need to think about. As painful as my sufferings are, and as I say, mine haven't been very great, I acknowledge that, and I'm really trying hard to be sensitive this morning. Yours may be much greater. But I tell you that when you suffer, as great as they are nothing compared with what you might have suffered if you went to hell.
You say, this is, my sufferings are gross.
Yep, I hear you. I tell you, hell is gross to the nth degree. Of course it hurts now. And sometimes it hurts very seriously and very deeply. When I know that Jesus has taken that suffering, which is so much greater by far, it is perspective. Now, friends, I'm just about done. If my suffering is enough now to make me despair of helping myself, and I pray it does, so that I come to Jesus for what I need. And if coming to Jesus means I don't suffer then, don't you reckon that's great grace? Don't you reckon that's wonderful grace? In the midst of pain and evil and suffering? But you see, what if you were to die? What if you were to leave this earth and you did not belong to Jesus? What if for you there's hell just there, where there's crying and gnashing of teeth day after day after day after day after day? What if that was you? You know you don't belong to Jesus. Well, I tell you, Jesus is saying to you, Jesus is saying, even by the things that go wrong in our world, see how awful it is? Don't go there. Whatever you do, don't go there. That's grace. They should speak to us through the suffering and evil of this world. And if you do leave this life belonging to Jesus, well, I can tell you, the Bible says that when you leave this life and you're with Jesus, he will wipe away every tear from your eye. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Revelation 22:4. You know, I have some friends, and I just think every day must be so painful for them because of mental illness. They can't escape from these awful thoughts that crowd in. They can't find purpose. They can't get answers. Everybody is a suspect. What do you think it's going to mean for those people on the day when Jesus wipes away those tears and takes away that illness? And all those days of tears, finished. Won't that be wonderful? You've suffered because your husband cheated on you. And every day you look at your wedding photo and you cry and you cry week after week after week after week. The day will come when Jesus will take his thing. Yeah, I like that. There'll be no more pain, no more weeping, no more evil, no more suffering. If Jesus has taken your suffering to himself, there's a bit now. There is a bit. Compared with what's then in hell, it's just light and momentary, as gross as it might be. God tells us that, so we won't go there. But instead, we'll make sure that we belong to him. Friends, there's a lot more we could say. But God's grace is intimately involved in suffering. Evil and suffering, part of his plan, you bet. For good purpose. That he might be glorified, that we might go to Jesus, and that we might see that our greatest suffering is taken by him. Some great books in the bookstall. If you'd like to read further, please do take a book there. I'd love to talk to you. If you think I've spoken insensitively or you'd like to speak about something personally, I'd love to do that with you if there's an opportunity.